As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
On this episode of the Most Notorious podcast, Wyoming's most infamous hired killer, Tom Horn, kills for the final time.
And what it appears is that Willie came to a gate, opened it, went through it, and all of a sudden was confronted by Tom Horn and ran for it and came back to the gate. And as he opened it, he was shot twice from long distance, both right through his torso. The second bullet in particular was certainly fatal.
Welcome, everyone, to the Most Notorious podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Hope you are doing well, or at least putting on a good face. I am so pleased to have as my guest today John W. Davis. He is a Wyoming attorney, an Old West scholar, and an award-winning author. His most recent book is called The Trial of Tom Horn, which documents the 1902 trial of one of the more notorious hired killers in the history of the West. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Glad to.
So, what prompted you to write a book about this case?
Well, I have been writing about the enormous problems with law and order in Wyoming in the late 19th and early 20th century since about 1900. For whatever reason, I became very interested in that subject. The obvious source of that, though, is that I practiced law in Wyoming for something like 43 years. I did a lot of trial law. I've always been interested in the history of Wyoming, but especially that which relates to the effect of law. And in doing that, I tried to hit the big cases that made a difference in terms of the Wyoming's quest for having a mature society. And before starting this book, I had written a book about the sheep raid problems in Wyoming. There were something like 10 men killed and dozens of raids and thousands of sheep, et cetera. But I hit that topic. And then I went to a broader look at all of the major problems that were existing in the West before, say, about 1890. There were enormous problems with assassination and raids and that kind of thing. Then the next book that I wrote was about the Johnson County War, the infamous event that occurred in 1892, in which 50 men rode north. There were cattle barons and their top hands, and then some 25 Texas gunmen. And they had a list of 70 men to kill, and they rode up to Buffalo to do that. And so when I started looking around for a new thing to write about, I started, for whatever reason, looking at the trial of Tom Horn and realizing that this was a subject that had some of the components that I wanted. The most important is that it ended up with a sensational trial. But there were other reasons. Like a lot of these kinds of highly emotional cases from that time, there were distortions, shall we say. I think I said something to the effect that the emotion of the original event created a trajectory almost certainly leading to errors. And they were certainly true in the Tom Horn case. And then finally, I realized that it was a kind of modified sheep case that had a significant landmark in this steady quest toward stopping extra-legal violence and getting law and order in Wyoming.
And when you talk about a sheep case, basically what was happening during this time is that cattle farmers were at odds, often violent odds, with sheep farmers.
Yes, very much so. For about 10 years there were dozens of raids around the state of Wyoming, and what happened typically is that some cowmen came in and shot up a sheep camp, and they killed 10 men all told from that. But they shot up the sheep, they shot the dogs, they burned things, they kidnapped people. They're just one-man crime waves. And how shall I say, there were good reasons for the conflict and also bad reasons. The appropriate reasons were that if sheep come in on a range, they eat right close to the ground. And what that means is that cattle can't come in behind them and then have any food. So bringing in sheep just ruins the range, which of course made cattlemen mad. The bad reasons arose from a lot of conflicts, prejudices, shall we say, that sheep were frequently led by Mormons, and Basques and Hispanic peoples, and there was a lot of racial prejudice with that. But one way or another, the whole thing had to stop. And I realized that the Tom Horn case was a very significant and important case for that final result.
So we'll definitely get into the trial. But if you don't mind, I want to back up just a little bit and ask you for a background on Tom Horn. A summary of his life up to his arrival in Wyoming, where the story takes place.
Okay. Well, he was born in Missouri, and he lived a rather sad early life. His father was something of a martinet and could be brutal. And, well, I remember there was this event just before Tom Horn decided to go west at age 13. That he had his pet dog killed. He was very close to the pet dog, and that's kind of understandable because your kids whose parents don't give them very much love and affection really attach to a pet, and that's what happened. And as he left, somebody just came in and killed his dog, and he said it affected him very deeply. And in some way, I think that this affected his insensitivity toward human suffering. But in any event, he told his dad he was going to do that. His dad beat him brutally, had to be in bed for a week before he could leave for the West. But then off he went to the West, most of it apparently walking, and he walked all the way to Arizona, where he lived with the Apaches for a good time. There's word was that he took an Apache wife and he had children. And then he sort of broke off from that and became involved in such things as some sheep raids in the areas of Arizona. And I think, I'm not sure exactly when it was, I want to say approximately 1892, he decided for whatever reason that he was going to go to Wyoming. And he drifted north. And when he got to Buffalo, Wyoming, I think he got there because they're just he arrived in May of 1892, and in April of 1892 was the time of this terrible Johnson County War. But he was perhaps interested in it, and he may also have had a semi-official basis for it because he had some connection with the Pinkertons. Well, it wasn't long from there that he drifted down to southeast Wyoming, and quickly found a niche there. After the 1892 Johnson County War, which has to be deemed a failure, although there were no convictions against the murdering cattlemen who went up there, the Wyoming Cattlemen's Association decided to I suppose they decided is not the right word. They were losing all kinds of money, so they had to get new sources of money. Until approximately 1893, that was an organization of rich men, rich autocratic men who sort of ruled brutally. But what happened here is that those rich men, a bunch of them were gone because they'd gone broke, and they decided they had to add the middle to lesser sorts of cattlemen. And that changed everything. That is, they could hardly advocate the kind of thing that they'd just done, the mass murder of small cattlemen anymore. And so what happened is that there was a small group of the cattle barons that broke off. And Tom Horn quickly found a happy home there. They found that Tom Horn was a very good instrument to enforce what they wanted, which is frankly brutality, intimidation, and murder. And he was responsible during these times for the shooting down of two homesteaders in 1895, who were shot from ambush, 150, 200 yards away, and both killed. In 1900, there was a similar kind of arrangement. And incidentally, we're just talking about the ones that we know about for sure. But in 1900, that occurred in a valley in Colorado. And he shot down two men. Then a little later, I think that year, about 1900, he got involved in chasing down the robbers of a train. $50,000 was stolen from that. I think Butch Cassidy was involved in it, and it's one of the opening scenes from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. So he was chasing after men and went up into northwest Wyoming and found two men that were just sort of camped out and gunned them down. At first, he went after the railroad and said, "Hey, I get a reward." But they apparently suspected what was going on, and so they refused to give him it. Then Horn's story about this changed, and he started talking about how he shot these guys, and then apparently in their last gasp, they said, "Well, no, we didn't rob the train, but we are rustlers." And I came away feeling that was probably made up by Tom Horn. So he had a long line of people that he killed. Well, what happened in 1901 was that a man named Kells Nickel, who lived in the Iron Mountain area in the Laramie Mountains that are north of Cheyenne. Kells Nickel brought 3,000 head of sheep in. And we think that was, I believe, and the people at the time believe it, that was the precipitating event that led to the gunman, Tom Horn, being hired. And as a matter of fact, it appeared that he was hired to kill Kells Nickel and that the killing of his 14-year-old son on July 19th, 1901, was not expected, although it was certainly intentional.
So his age at this point, Horn, he was born in 1860. So he was 41, 42 during the time the murder and the trial took place.
Yeah, that's right. He was. And he was sort of well settled. He lived an odd life in some ways. He liked women. We know that. But unfortunately, most of the time they ended up being prostitutes, I think. He liked the outdoor life that he led. He was a fairly adventuresome sort. He had been he for example, went to Cuba with Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders, and he was in charge of the mule train, played an important part in supplying the men in Teddy Roosevelt's command in Cuba. He came back, had to recover from yellow fever, and away he went. But he was well-known and very notorious at the time. But in some form or another, I believe that the big cattlemen in the Iron Mountain area where Kells Nickel lived decided they wanted to kill him because he brought in these sheep. And an obvious candidate for that was Tom Horn. And he was hired. And what it appears, this came out during the trial and from various testimonial evidence, what it appears is that Tom Horn was nosing around the Kells Nickel Ranch, waiting for an opportunity, no doubt, to do the same thing he'd done to several other people, that is, gun them down from hiding. And on the morning of July 19th, 1901, Kells Nichols' son, Willie Nichol, was sent from the ranch over to a local small town to find a sheep herder. And he followed the normal road out of his homestead that his father would have. And what it appears is that Willie came to a gate, opened it, went through it, and all of a sudden was confronted by Tom Horn and ran for it and came back to the gate. And as he opened it, he was shot twice from long distance, both right through his torso. The second bullet in particular was certainly fatal. And then he ran, and if you ever hunt a deer, you hit a deer in the heart, and it runs and then collapses. And that's what poor Willie Nichol did. And the gunman, this they found out before they knew who it was, obviously came up, turned the boy over, lifted up his shirt to see that it's his handiwork, and then just left him lying there. It was a day later that the Nichol family, which couldn't figure out why Willie hadn't come back, was confronted with this terrible thing where a younger brother went off to that same area. His duties involved putting a cattle herd there, their milk herd or something like that, and he found his brother's body. And he came in, and he was sobbing, and his mother said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "You know, Willie is murdered." And then began the involvement of the local authorities. They went through an extensive coroner's inquest, which resulted in a trial. And, well, let me go into some of this. I don't mean to rattle on, but the coroner's inquest was a very interesting proceeding. It was a proceeding that was held quite a bit back then, that time in 1900 or so, when you had a suspicious death, to determine the cause of the death and if possible, who did it. And the county attorney, a man named Walter Stoll, came up from Cheyenne and started the inquest actually out there in the Kells Nichols home, then had to go down to Cheyenne. And they interviewed a lot of different people. They found out who was in the area. They pretty quickly figured out that Tom Horn had been in the area. He was well known as an assassin. I mean, one reason he was, incidentally, is that when he lived in Cheyenne, he was a substantial drinker. And he'd go into bars and start drinking and start bragging over the people he killed. So he was a natural target. But in the original inquest, they couldn't really establish anything. They couldn't establish that Horn had been there, anything showing that he had fired the weapon. I should say that Kells Nichol was a contentious neighbor, and he was feuding with all of his neighbors. And so one of the things that the coroner's inquest people looked at were the neighbors that he feuded with, see whether there's any basis to say that some of them might have committed this murder, but that didn't follow through. So they finally, they adjourned the whole thing, and they said that he had met his death at the hand or hands of a person or persons unknown. In other words, we don't know who in the world did this terrible thing. And the newspapers followed it very closely from the beginning. You weren't that far away from Cheyenne, and Cheyenne had three excellent dailies. But they said, you know, just looks like it's going to be another case that we'll never be able to find it. But about 10 days later, Tom Horn was arrested. And that was a sensational thing. Tom Horn at the time was a very notorious guy. It wasn't simply the fact that he was believed to be a killer. He was also quite an exceptional athlete. He won some of the competitions at Frontier Days, which even back then in Cheyenne was a world-class rodeo. He was quite renowned is perhaps too strong, but for those who knew, they saw him as an exceptional weaver. When he was with the Apaches, it was believed that he learned how to weave and construct hand items of one kind or another, everything from ropes to some very sophisticated things such as bridles. There's a wonderful one that was that I have shown people from a Northern Wyoming museum. But in any event, he had exceptional talent. But the papers were so interested in him that every newspaper in Wyoming, if he blinked, they would talk about him. I found that out when I did a word search over all of the old Wyoming newspapers. You can do that through a certain computer program. And I put it in, boom. I think it was 9,801 hits because they just absolutely couldn't get enough of him. And so here was the huge interest. The newspaper stories all over the place. Everybody in the town was just wanted to know what was going on. And then suddenly there was this arrest. And so they started up the proceeding, preliminary hearing, and the courtroom was absolutely filled. People that wanted to know what in the world was going on with Tom Horn. And they didn't know. And at first, in the morning, they talked about this and that and whatever, and just general stuff, showing, setting the location, et cetera. But then a man came to the stand whose name was Joe LaForce. He was a United States Deputy Marshal, and he was a rather renowned detective, rather remarkable fellow. And he got up in the stand, and he started talking. And what tale he told was a long story. I won't go into all of it. But what it came down to is that he found a way to get Tom Horn to think that he, Joe LaForce, was a friend. And they got together, and they were drinking some. And Tom Horn, and LaForce had figured this out before, loved to brag. He was an insecure man, and he wanted to talk about some of his feats in life. And Joe LaForce handled it very cleverly so that by just sort of throwing out tidbits, he kept Horn talking, and Horn confessed to everything. He didn't tell exactly who were his employers at the time, but it was obvious that he had employers, where he was hiding in ambush, what he did when the boy fled, why he shot the boy, what he did thereafter to conceal his whereabouts, his activity there. So, I mean, it was a full-throated confession. And the newspapers talked about it, how when it came out, Tom Horn was standing there seemingly with open jaw and his eyes popping out, couldn't believe that all this stuff was coming out. He also confessed to some other murders, too. The four of the murders that I mentioned, he made very incriminating statements about those. And so, boy, oh, boy, they bound him over. Well, here was this notorious fellow who had strong support from the cattlemen, but, boy, had he put his foot into it. But nevertheless, the cattlemen hired the best lawyers in the area, and they proceeded to provide him with a defense. Their only problem was that one of the best lawyers in the area was that prosecutor. He was really an exceptional prosecutor. But those lawyers pretty quickly figured out that if that confession is the only thing we have here, if that's what the jury decides on, our guy is dead. So what they did, and this is a surprising thing, most of the trial focused on the testimony of doctors, very abstruse, very detailed, following the knowledge of the day, but nevertheless pretty highbrow stuff. And the purpose here was that the defense, which was supported by a lot of well-to-do cattlemen and had some real clout, hauled up a whole bunch of doctors who said that it couldn't possibly have been Tom Horn who shot Willie Nichols, because Tom Horn shot a .30-30, which is a rifle with a diameter of 3/100ths of an inch. And the holes, the contention on the part of the defense was that Willie Nichols couldn't possibly have been shot by Tom Horn, because Tom Horn had a .30-30 rifle. And a .30-30 rifle is a rifle which shoots a projectile that is 3/100ths of an inch in diameter. And these doctors testified that the holes that were found in poor Willie's body showed that the rifle that shot him had to be at least 3/8ths of an inch, that is 0.375, significantly larger than a 30 caliber, or maybe larger, maybe like a 45/100ths of a caliber. Okay, and by such an attack, what they were trying to do is to show to make that confession irrelevant. They're showing this simply couldn't possibly be true. Well, the bad thing from their standpoint is that they had, as I say, the prosecutor was superb. He had anticipated all of this coming down, and he had, first place, his cross-examination of the doctors for the defense, the ones who said it could have been Tom Horn, was excellent. It impaired what they were saying. And then this attorney, again, his name is Walter Stoll, found physicians of his own who gave good, solid reasons why it definitely was that the bullet fit with the 30 caliber. That is, the you could not determine from the size of that bullet hole in the body what the actual size of the caliber was. And did a just a terrific job on it. There were a lot of factors involved. One of the factors is that there was not an autopsy, and by modern terms, or under modern definition, it wasn't an autopsy at all. They didn't penetrate the body. But they didn't do anything for 3 days. And remember, we're talking about the middle of July. And I won't go into it in detail, but Walter Stoll conducted some of the most clever cross-examination I've ever heard. And this was of special interest to me because I was a trial attorney. I studied cross-examination. I believe that it was the most significant aspect of any trial, whether it's a criminal or civil trial, to read the transcript of a real master in addressing this most important of cases was just, to me, a very exciting thing to do. And I dwelt on it at some length. As I say, that was a surprising thing that you had these physicians being grilled on the finest points of whether or not Tom Horn could have killed Willie Nichols. And there were other aspects of it. But what the significance of this more than anything else, the significance of the strong showing by the prosecutor is that the jury then turned to the confession. And to make a long story short, they went back in, and 3 hours later they came back and they found him guilty. And when the press talked to the jury, they all said, Tom Horn did testify. They said when he got up there and he testified, what the prosecutor did is he took him over item by item of the confession. They had an actual transcript of it. And when he did that, Tom Horn just wasn't up to it. Well, frankly, I can't see how he could be up to it because it was very apparently a lie. And the jury said, we did not believe him. The more he talked, the tighter the noose got. And this was especially significant because Tom Horn got a very, very favorable jury, including a couple of friends. But it didn't matter. The prosecution had done such an effective job that he was found guilty anyway.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mischief Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies?
Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, Box of Oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the Box of Oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day, there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. Today could be the day a famous mobster met their end, or the first milestone for humans in space. Who knows what history today holds? Find out when you listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
So I want to go to the motive here. He was hired, of course, by someone, as you've said. Did the prosecutor attempt to determine the identity of the person who hired Tom Horn to kill Kells Nickel?
Yes, they did. They went after it. There was a lot of talk about the newspapers saying if Tom Horn is found guilty, we're going to find out who hired him. And they're the ones who got to go to the gallows, too. The only problem is that that couldn't be raised in the first trial. It wasn't relevant in the first trial. And even though everybody predicted that Tom Horn would break down and would tell the names of his bosses. And incidentally, Joe LaForce, the guy who got the confession, also got some wonderful evidence out of some of these guys, fooled them into talking to him. But Horn managed to sort of worm his way, not Horn rather, but LaForce, managed to worm his way into the confidence of one of the cattlemen and get admissions from the cattlemen that pretty clearly showed that the cattlemen had been the ones who had hired Horn and had asked him to proceed that way. But anyway, the cattlemen continued to support him. They financed a big appeal to the Wyoming Supreme Court. The Wyoming Supreme Court talked about what a superior job it was, but they would not overturn it. Then they went into the governor of the state of Wyoming and tried to get clemency. And normally big cattlemen would have a special force that way, but it didn't work that way either. Anyway, so the upshot was that in late 1902, Tom Horn was taken into the he was already at the Laramie County Jail. That's Cheyenne is the county seat of Laramie County. And he was hung.
And the way he was hung, it was a very uniquely built scaffold.
It was. It was quite different. There was a Wyoming inventor. I think it was a physician. And they were trying to look for a way that where you could. Apparently they had some problem finding hangmen. And so this one fellow, this physician, I believe, came up with an idea of constructing a machine whereby you really didn't have a guy who pulled any kind of rope. It was a device whereby you set the man to be executed on a little platform. And what that did also is it triggered the dripping of water into a weight or into one, and I'm not sure exactly how it was connected, but it was connected to that little platform. And once it reached a certain point and a certain weight, it caused things to fall and the platform collapsed. Down he went and is hung immediately. And in fact, he hung himself.
Didn't they make a mistake in measuring his weight?
In fact, let me mention Tom Horn again. I haven't talked about him too much personally. he was an interesting man physically, because he was a great big guy for that time, 6'1 or 6'2, 204 pounds. And there are pictures of him with other men, and he just towered over him. But after he was arrested and he sat in jail for something like a year, he seemed always to be very cool about the whole thing. But they found, the authorities found that when they cut Tom Horn down, that the fall had practically decapitated him, which is a mistake. I mean, sometimes incompetent hangmen would do that. Well, the reason for that became apparent when they weighed Tom Horn. They found that he only weighed 155 pounds, not the some 204 pounds that he had before all of this started. And Tom Horn had always presented an unworried face. You know, they always wanted to stay cool under all circumstances. But what was apparent was that his arrest, his conviction, and his execution was, in fact, worrying him a great deal to lose that kind of weight.
So the defense, during the trial, they claimed, of course, that Tom Horn was not Willie Nichols' killer. Did they introduce other suspects? Did they try to shift the blame to someone else?
They did, and they did a very good job of putting them forward. The problem was is that the prosecution always found some clever way to show that they were wrong about that. I talk about it in some detail. As I say, I've tried a lot of cases in my life and can appreciate a master at work. And time and again, I found that this fellow, Walter Stoll, set up his presentation of the evidence and the persuasiveness of it so cleverly that in the end, they went with him.
One of the suspicions initially was that the murderer was a member of a rival family to the Nichols, the Miller family. Kells Nichol had a blood feud basically going on with the patriarch of the Miller clan, Jim Miller. And it was suspected that maybe one of the Miller boys committed the murder.
That's exactly what they did talk about. And it was addressed very early. Remember, I talked about the coroner's inquest. That's the family that the prosecuting attorney hit right away. He was going to talk about, where were you during this time? And what did you do? And what kind of rifle do you have? And all that kind of thing. But they just didn't develop anything. And what was apparent after a while is that even though there was a lot of feuding, that these boys, and they were 13, 14, 15-year-old boys, were actually friends. And when it finally came down to it, it was very clear that nobody in the Miller family was guilty of this. Now, I've had my suspicions that the Miller family may have known that some of this was coming down. And I believe that the people who paid Tom Horn were other large ranchers in the area. But in any event, it was pretty clear when it was finally done that it wasn't the Miller family.
One of the interesting witnesses was kind of a love interest to Tom Horn. She was a school teacher in a very precarious position. She was at the point of the murder. She was being paid to teach both the Nichol and the Miller children in this little schoolhouse. And she found herself in the middle of this whole thing.
She did. Her name was Gwendolyn Myrtle Kimmel. And she was very interesting. She was interesting for a lot of reasons. She was a tiny woman, something like 5 foot tall. But one of the things that was interesting is that before Willie Nichol was killed, these two kind of got together with other people around. But it was obvious to everybody there that they were immediately interested in one another. And by some of the writings, later writings, it was obvious that Gwendolyn Kimmel had a crush on this man. She later came to the fore and in the proceeding before the governor, she tried to get Tom Horn off by some of her testimony, which was shown not to be reliable. But there was an interesting connection. She was a bright, pretty, kind of sexy. There was some of the comments were made at the time would indicate that she was quite appealing to men. And then one of the things I talk about somewhat in my book is that it looks like they should have gotten together. because in 2010 or whatever the year was I wrote this, that's what young people do. They start living together, but they didn't back in 1900. And nothing ever came of it, but it was a rather fascinating interlude. Let me mention something else, too. One of the fables about this case has long been that the cattleman somehow set Tom Horn up and let him down, and that the trial was little more than a prelude to a lynching. Well, as I mentioned, I found that when his years drag on, you come up with fables. And this I finally determined was definitely a fable, because the attorneys that were hired by the big cattleman to help their client, Tom Horn, were truly excellent. They came up with one thing after another, and they had to push the prosecutor, Walter Stoll, to the brilliance that he exhibited. It was probably his most brilliant case, and one of the reasons why is that the other side was always come up with stuff that, on the face of it, looked like, boy, this is killer testimony. And again, the prosecutor always found the hidden clue to show that what they were trying to put forward just wasn't correct.
So some of us have the high noon image in our minds when talking about gunfighters, old West killers, but Tom Horn didn't do that. I mean, he was an ambusher. He murdered people with his rifle from long distances, hidden from view, in a cowardly way.
Well, yes, but actually the face-to-face draw at high noon in the middle of the main street was something of a fable. That almost never happened. I guess the closest thing, too, is probably the stuff down in Tombstone. But by and large, the killings like that, it was true in Wyoming, I think it was true in other states, were from ambush when some gunman shot them down from a distance.
So Tom Horn never admitted who his employer was. But you have your suspicions. Who do you believe hired him to kill Kells Nickel?
Well, Tom Horn was an employee of a man named John Coble, who was one of the big ranchers in that area. And John Coble was sort of his factor, who would deal with other people. And there's pretty good reason to believe that Coble was approached by several of the ranchers in the area, some of the larger ranchers in the area, call them four or five, and hire Tom Horn. And Tom Horn talked about monies that he received for this, incidentally.
So was there any especially damning piece of evidence in the trial?
Yes. Well, the trial, as I say, finally came down to, due to the very good lawyering of Stoll, the trial finally came down to that confession. And what Tom Horn decided to do, and it was him, wasn't his lawyers. I think it was probably at the in opposition to their advice. But he decided to go in there and admit that he had said everything that was alleged by Joe LaForce and other witnesses that he had said. And he came up with a story about how the comments that he made about killing men, about hiding in ambush, making such a good shot. I mean, he said things supposedly such as it was the best shot I'd ever made and the dirtiest trick I'd ever done, that all of that was joshing. Tom Horn said that whenever I got together with Joe LaForce, we always talk about the men that we killed. And so all of us were having this little contest. And he was saying that men he killed, and then I talked about the men that I killed. I wasn't about to be exaggerated by Joe LaForce. And the jury, who knew him well, I go into that in some detail in the book, sat there and listened to him very closely. When they came out and talked to the newspapers, they said the moment he started talking and the more he talked, the tighter the news got. It was just not believable. And that was, again, a product, I think, of some excellent cross-examination by the prosecutor. One of the hardest things to do, if you've ever cross-examined, is to sort of go light sometimes. And what the prosecutor decided to do is go through every one of those statements, just sort of follow up the things that Tom Horn had said that I really didn't believe those. And, you know, just sort of a nice, easy, underhanded softball to this guy and get him talking. And the more he talked, the worse and worse it got. And as I say, that's what the jury thought, too. So, and it is a psychologically hard thing to do if you're a prosecutor. But the prosecutor did so. It was a brilliant move, and it ensured the conviction.
The wild thing about that confession is that LaForce had a stenographer hiding in a closet recording that confession. And he really covered his butt on that, didn't he?
He did it beautifully. Of course, you got to give some credit to the prosecutor. The prosecutor, apparently at one point, when LaForce proposed this arrangement, he said, get somebody close by. It was handled very well, but the prosecution or the authorities at the time were lucky in that one of the first things that Tom Horn said to LaForce when they got together on this fateful day was, let's go to some private place, like your office. And LaForce said, yeah, well, I guess so. And after he found that out, he managed to find an excuse to split off, and he went to these two men that he prearranged with put them in a closet. And there was a court reporter who took shorthand and took it all the way down, and there was a deputy. And the reason for the deputy is that they were so close that the prosecution, the prosecuting authorities, believed that there's a chance that Tom Horn would hear about it and come busting in that door with guns blazing. So they wanted a deputy there to counter him if he did. Fortunately, he never did hear anything.
Right.
I'm sure during all of that, they were holding their breath a goodly amount of the time. The court stenographer is not a fellow who's involved with these kinds of wild adventures normally. He leads his life in a rather staid and sedate way.
After Horn's conviction and hoping for clemency, there was a plan, right, to break him out of jail.
There were a lot of stories about it that ended up in the newspapers. And given how it all finally came forth, I had to conclude that most of those wild stories were right. And what finally happened is that his friends on the outside, Horn's friends on the outside, managed to smuggle somebody in the jail who would provide information back to the people who wanted to get Horn out of jail. In any event, the plan was that Horn and another man who was there would overpower the deputy and escape. And in fact, that's what they did. And there was a big fight back and forth. The deputy was incredibly lucky he wasn't killed because Tom Horn had managed to get a hold of a pistol. And in the course of wrestling around with Tom Horn, this deputy had managed to put on this safety, and it was a Belgian pistol, and it was an odd safety. But when Tom Horn finally wrestled away the pistol away from him, he tried to shoot the guy, but he couldn't fire the weapon. Anyway, then he I don't know if he threw it down, but then he went running out, and the jail at that time was close to downtown Cheyenne, and he started running around Cheyenne, and a bunch of men noticed that he was going out. Apparently the word spread pretty quickly, and they went running after him. And it was a Sunday morning, but amazingly, there were all sorts of men at work, and they had guns. And it might have turned into an absolute disaster because they chased after him and fired away, with a bunch of people down there shopping. It's amazing a dozen innocent bystanders were killed. But finally, Horn tried to fire back again with that pistol, couldn't do it. They caught him, beat him up some, and brought him back. And anyway, they thereafter put him in the cell and set up a Gatling gun in there to make sure that wasn't going to happen again.
So was Kells, Nickel, and his family, were they satisfied with the verdict?
They were, although one of the interesting things was that, remember I talked about how they walked this guy back to the cell? And Kells Nichols showed up in there and started haranguing the crowd. Somebody get a rope. Get a rope. You know, we can settle this right now. And about that time, the sheriff showed up. And the sheriff walked over to Kells Nichols and said, if you don't shut up, I'm going to put you in the jail cell with Tom Hart. So Kells Nichols shut up. And they got him back in the cell.
I'm sure, yeah. So Horn, as he waited for his execution, did he hold out hopes to the very end for a pardon?
He appears to have believed that. But nevertheless, he was calm through it all, and no matter what happened, it was a remarkable thing. They tell this story about how there were some people coming to interview him a day or two before he was executed. And the workmen there were building the scaffold, and they were testing it and banging it around. So you could clearly see, you know, the drop mechanism was, and apparently it didn't phase Horn a bit. But as I've said before, that he put on a good front, but underneath all that, it really did.
So you don't think that there is any question that Tom Horn murdered Willie Nickel, right?
I don't. And I, one of the fellows who was the reader of my manuscript, who strongly recommended that it be printed, believed otherwise. But he's a good guy, and I always respected him and tried to work with him and all that. But this fellow was one of those who, with other people, spread it around a certain kind of group that read stories about the Old West, that Tom Horn was railroaded, that the big cattlemen were doing him in so he wouldn't squeal on them and all that kind of thing. None of that worked out. And that is, when I looked at it and compared it to the facts as I knew them, and I had a wonderful body of facts. I won't go into the details, but I just had a mountain of evidence. I had to conclude that idea that he was somehow railroaded was simply wrong.
For those people out there who don't believe Tom Horn committed the murder, who is the person that they think did it?
There's a lot thrown around. The Millers is one. They talk about some other ranch families or other people. What they also say is that the defense was done so poorly that they were certain to get a conviction when he was obviously innocent. And as I say, and as I think this has really been the theme of a lot of what I've said, the case was not as represented today. And in fact, the prosecution was superb. The defense was superb. I looked at that case as a litigation masterpiece. And it wasn't because anybody led him to the scaffold, so to speak, but simply because the prosecutor did such a strong and good job of showing that, in fact, Tom Horn was guilty of exactly what he was charged with.
And you make that point in your book as well. Even if he had been found not guilty of killing Willie Nickel, he had already admitted to other murders in that confession, and it was probably inevitable that he would hang soon.
He did confess it, and they were bad statements. And the authorities in Laramie County, where two of the men were killed, took note of that and said that if he's not convicted in this case, we're going to try him. The authorities in Colorado said if he's not convicted in this case, we want him. So you're right. Yeah, he was in trouble either way.
So are there any physical locations related to the murder or the trial that still exist that people can actually go to and visit now?
There are. And there is the original U.S. Marshal's office is still there. It's on Lincoln Avenue, which is also U.S. Highway 16. And it's in downtown Cheyenne, and it's only three or four blocks. What's the direction there? I think it's directly to the west. that where you come to it and the people who own that building leave it open so that you could take an elevator up there and you can go into the same room. And you've still got the closet there. And some of the furnishing is the same. And it's a marvelous place to go to. I went there several times, and if anybody goes through Cheyenne, that's a good thing to do. You know, and I quickly was, I interrupt myself too much to go to the exact location, but it's 3 or 4 blocks, as I say, to the east of downtown Cheyenne. And the people say at any of the historical society or the Wyoming archives would know exactly where to get to. And I'd recommend it because it's fascinating. And let me tell you, there's another place you could go to. I went there a couple times, deep in the heart of the jungle, actually deep in the heart of the forest, Laramie Mountain Forest, there exists the fence. And remember I talked about the fence that Willie Nickel came to and he opened, and he went through and he closed and he came back to and he was shot there and all that sort of thing. That fence is existent. You can see it. The gate is existent. You can see that. And the setting is very similar. Now, the difference is that you have a vegetation that has fallen down and some is new grown up, which is significant from the standpoint of figuring out such things as line of sight fire, you know, where the killer might have been, that kind of thing. But nevertheless, going to that place gives you a darn good feeling about exactly what it looked like to Willie Nichols on July 19, 1901. The one bad thing about that is it's not like the old marshal's office. It's private land, and I don't know whether folks would let you on or not. But I went on there with a couple of esteemed writers, and so they were good enough to let us go on the land.
Wow, that's incredible. And they are aware of that, and the owners keep it there for historical reasons.
They absolutely do. And I say good for them. Yes.
Well, this has been excellent. So your book is available through Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and it can be ordered through independent bookstores too.
Yes. Yes, they can. You can order it directly from the University of Oklahoma Press. If you wander through Worland, Wyoming, I've got them. So, anyway.
Well, great. This has been so much fun. Thanks again.
Sure. Glad to do it.
Again, I have been speaking to John W. Davis. His book is called The Trial of Tom Horn. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.